Welcome back to another edition of Thinking Cultura here on Open Lab. And our next conversation is with Isabel Bruce, a campaigner and storyteller whose work harnesses culture as a force for narrative change across climate, democracy, refugee rights, and gender justice. She works at the sharp edge of storytelling where ideas don't just inspire, they mobilize. Isabel, welcome to Open Lab.
Thank you so much, Jo. It's brilliant to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your work at Purpose, just to get things started.
Yes, I've been at Purpose for about 6 years, where I am the global head of campaigns. I work on a few of our bigger programs, global programs, which are running at the moment in Brazil, Indonesia, India, lots of really interesting work around mis and disinformation in climate change, and also launching a global food program, which is focused on food and nutrition.
And how long, so you've been there for 6 years?
6 years, yeah.
Are you feeling, you know, like this is kind of like your calling in life?
Yeah, actually, it's funny because I didn't start out working in social impact. I often describe my career as kind of like a Goldilocks career. I tried lots of different things, and I liked some bits of some things and some bits of other things. I actually began in theatre and then in production, live events production. I worked for an organisation called Secret Cinema for a long time. I worked for charities. I worked for Mind, the mental health charity. I worked in corporate advertising, and I kind of took a little bit of everything that I liked from all of those different things. And what I found at Purpose was a really beautiful way that all came together in terms of the way that I get to think creatively, the way that I get to think strategically. I really like the project-based nature of the work. And I also like the fact that I get to learn a lot about issues, about different geographies. I get to work in lots of different countries with a lot of different really amazing people. And it's an amazing team. Everybody at Purpose is super clever and very, very good at what they do.
Interesting. Now, I always wanted to go to Secret Cinema, actually. I always saw my friends posting all these incredible photos of all these amazing outfits that they'd conjured up for that. What were you doing at Secret Cinema, just before we carry on?
Yeah, I worked, I came on as kind of a producer, but then I ended up doing a lot of their digital work, which is kind of how I ended up where I am now, sort of by a roundabout way, running their social media channels. But also I strangely ended up also doing a lot of production on their charitable events. And then I also oversaw Future Shorts, which is their short film festival. So the distribution, the marketing, the sales on that as well. So it's kind of a strange little role. It's changed a lot now. It's from when I was there, which was, you know, a decade ago. But it was a very small sort of team that managed a lot of different things. So that suited me quite well because I'm quite used to wearing a lot of hats.
Which is quite handy in a fancy dress cinema situation.
Yeah, by the time it's literally, yes.
So you describe culture as a powerful force for narrative change. What does that actually mean in practice then, not in theory?
Absolutely, and it's something that I am very passionate about, so it's something I'm really glad to talk about. So I think that a lot of traditional campaigning, and by the way, there's no criticism of every part of campaigning has a role in culture and society, but a lot of the ways that we have begun to communicate, especially with the sort of proliferation of the internet, it means that people's ability to receive information has fundamentally shifted. And really, in order to especially when we're talking about these big issues like climate, which can feel impossible for people to receive direct messages on because they're receiving so much information all the time. And also, you know, when you've got really difficult daily choices to make, when you're struggling with your, you know, ability to pay your bills, to eat your food, to do the basics of life, it's very hard to take on something like climate change, which seems far away in the future and something that, what are you really going to do about it anyway? So that, I think climate's a good issue to bring into this when we're talking about why culture is so important, because we need to make climate feel like something that people are able to understand as fundamental to their lives. And the way that you can do that through culture rather than, you know, spouting facts at people and saying the temperatures are going up, the temperatures are going up, which doesn't feel immediate and like something that they're able to really act on. If you make it about, if you build that storytelling into the media that people are experiencing, into music, into films, into novels, and also into the way that business leaders talk, and you make it more about the immediate things in people's worlds that they can experience, then we can change the way that people behave and perceive their world. And I think that that is going to be the way that we're going to start to see more action at the where we need the action, by the way, because I'm not talking about people changing their behavior around using plastics or straws, or their individual behavior on, you know, choosing to drive or walk to work. Those, and again, not saying that those things aren't important, but where we need to see the shift right now is at a systems level. And the only way that you can get that change to happen is to shift the culture. You need people en masse to change what they're demanding from their leaders.
So when you look at the world right now, what narratives would you say that we're actually trapped inside?
Oh gosh, that's a big question. I mean, I think the thing that I think about a lot is, and this is, you know, something that I do touch on in my TED talk, is the fact that what we're seeing is a lot of echo chambers and people being dragged into very polar perspectives. And it's kind of a function of the way our information systems work. A lot of information systems really reward that extremism. They don't function well on sort of down the middle, rational narratives. What they operate well on is people feeling outraged, people feeling angry, people having really big reactions to things. And that's where you get this kind of functional, if you want, left-right split, or populist to, like you're seeing in the UK right now, right? You've got Reform on one side, you've got the Greens on the other side, if you wanted to split it down that way. I don't always find actually that left-right is a useful way to split things. And then you're also seeing a very low level of media literacy and, you know, an injection of AI information. And for me, there are also some really difficult prevalent narratives, but more than that, people's ability to manage that information system and the information integrity, as we sort of call it in the United Nations system, for example, is becoming completely eroded. And people's ability to manage that and from their daily lives to their political engagement is basically posing a fundamental risk to our societies, to our democracies.
one issue space, like climate, democracy, gender violence, where you've seen storytelling genuinely shift outcomes and not just awareness?
I think that's a really, really good question. I think we are seeing it in climate, for sure. I think we're seeing a huge shift. For example, 2 years ago, when we launched the campaign that I oversee right now, Verified for Climate, our main objective on the program is to get people to demand more rapid response on energy transition from their leadership. So we went in with an assumption that what we needed to do was shift people's perceptions on energy. And maybe they didn't understand what solutions were available. But actually, when we did our primary research, we did some message testing in the geographies that we are operating in. We found that people were very aware of the solutions, and they did really already want to see more rapid transition, but they just didn't know who to demand that from or how to demand it. And similarly, we did a big piece of research in Europe with right-leaning audiences, conservative audiences, which again, we have an assumption that these audiences don't already want to demand these things from their leaders, or they're like anti-climate, or they're against green energy. Overwhelmingly, they're not. And I think that is because there has been a cultural shift. There has been a normalization, a norming of green energy as being a good solution. We've seen a huge uptick in the use of electric vehicles. We've seen a huge uptake in, solutions like solar and wind energy becoming normalized. And I do think that is also because it's been normalized through culture and the way that we experience those things.
So, I mean, you know, obviously the theme this year is thinking culture. So I guess that, you know, was something perhaps that maybe led you to want to get involved this year. I mean, is TEDx Ibiza something that you've had your eye on for a while, or was it just literally coming into your kind of consciousness this year?
Well, so actually my mum has lived and worked in Ibiza for over 20 years. So I have been coming to Ibiza at least 2-3 times a year for a very long time. And it was kind of a chance encounter, actually, with somebody who was working with TEDx at a lunch. And we were having a conversation. And a couple of months later, she sent me a message saying, hey, I'm helping to advise the board on who to bring on to talk about things. And I thought that actually you have some really interesting things to say. And my first response was actually, what? Like, I'm not going to give a TED talk, don't be silly. But actually, looking at the theme and looking at, like you say, thinking culture, but also there was something about democracy and hope and digital spaces as well, that I really did feel like, actually, I do have something to say here. And this is an interesting, terrifying challenge for me. So that's kind of how it happened.
Obviously, having, you know, your mum here for 20 years, you've obviously spent quite a bit of time here. And, you know, how do you kind of feel about something like TEDx coming to Ibiza and obviously being able to share these narratives and talks like yours, and obviously the people that you meet through working on a project like this?
Yeah, and it's a really amazing diversity of thought on the programme as well. I've been lucky enough to be able to hear at least snippets of everybody's talks and rehearsal, and I think it's an incredible programme. I think Ibiza is a really interesting melting pot of a place, because you have a very strong local Ibizaic culture that I think... you know, if you spend enough time there, at least, which I know a lot of people potentially don't spend as much time in the campo, in, you know, with the local community, but there's a very strong local culture. There's also a lot of people from all over the world bringing a lot of different perspectives. And obviously, traditionally, it's a very, well, not hippie, but like artistic, alternative. And I think that it's a place where ideas thrive. And I think it's a really interesting place to bring different perspectives to light.
I mean, obviously, the idea of TEDx specifically, which is a community organised event for the local community of Ibiza, the premise of that is kind of the talks are all about creating a new idea worth sharing. So I'm wondering if there was one thing that you want people to take away from your talk, which is actually the final talk, so no pressure on stage, the headline act. What is it that you would like people to kind of remember from that talk that you're going to be giving?
So I actually tell quite a personal story. So I am talking about my work and my campaigning, but I am framing it in a more personal story of finding that a family member has become polarized via the internet. And I think that that is something that is quite a common experience for people nowadays. And what I'm speaking to is something else that I observe in my working life, in my daily life, is a lack of tolerance for disagreement. And my theory is that this is exacerbated by polarization, especially online, where people are encouraged to have strongly held, firm opinions immediately in the moment, and also to cling strongly, like cling your identity really strongly to those opinions. And what I really want, like the one thing that I would want people to take away, is to stop and listen and have empathy, even when somebody's opinion is uncomfortable and difficult to deal with. Because my feeling is that if we stop learning how to build that muscle to disagree well, that's going to bleed even more strongly into our societies. And again, we're going to see more and more of a split. So yes, I'm hoping that what I'm really trying to teach is my experience with how to listen and have empathy, even when it's very hard to.
So in that case, I mean, who do you think is kind of controlling the narrative today? Is it governments, media, algorithms, influencers? And where do the movements actually sit within that ecosystem, if this is the result of all of that?
I mean, look, we're sitting in a very interesting week, right? For media environments, and a lot of information is sort of actually coming to the fore in terms of who is really in control, I think it's often follow the money, isn't it? Like whether you're looking at climate, whether you're looking at, you know, the radicalization of young men and the manosphere, it's pointing upwards to the tech companies. It's pointing upwards to even above that though, right? You've got these very powerful people who are machinating and have inordinate sums of cash. I can give you a direct statistic on the climate space, for example. Every year, the fossil fuel industry and actors that are interested in the finances of that pump $3 trillion of money into communications efforts to muddy the waters. And these are very sophisticated efforts. They're not just one thing, it's many different things. And you might not even know where and how you're experiencing those things. They're all made to erode people's trust in renewable energy, to erode people's understanding of why fossil fuels need to be, you know, phased out. And the effort on the other side is so much more fragmented. There is nowhere near as much funding. There is nowhere near as much unifying message. And also you get a thing of where people are in very good faith trying to do interventions on specific audiences, for example, whereas on the other side, it's a carpet. You know, it's everywhere all at once. So when you look at it in that context and you think about all of the issues that are being manipulated in this way, it's not a fair fight, if you see what I mean. Like there's an agenda on one, and I'm not trying to create like a conspiracy theory narrative myself, but again, like it's always about the money, isn't it? It's always about who looks to profit from people's division, who looks to profit from people behaving and responding in a certain way.
Well, you can't really compete with $3 trillion. That's a lot of money, and no, you know, organization that is trying to create what we would assume would be the real narrative would be able to fight that. And where do you get that information from then? How do you know that this is actually happening?
That information was, so I'm a part of an effort within the United Nations called the Information Integrity Hub for Climate Communications, which is they love a mouthful. And that statistic comes out of some research that partners engaged with that have generated. There's a lot of efforts across Europe. And just to be more positive, there are a lot of efforts that are going really well. For example, there's these networks of actors, especially in the advertising space, that are gaining a lot of traction. And for example, in the Netherlands, it's become the first country that has completely banned any fossil fuel actors from the advertising space, in the same way that, you know, cigarettes were banned, in the same way that we have successfully done this in other industries before. They have banned fossil fuel actors, and that's because of this kind of effort.
Wow, fascinating. I had no idea that you were working for the United Nations as well. I mean, is there, do you think, a danger then that storytelling is becoming an aesthetic activism, beautifully packaged but not really structurally disruptive?
I think, again, that's where culture comes into it, is the only way that you can disrupt structures is for it to not rest on individual campaigns. And again, I think that's where it's really about trying to bring these bigger institutional actors on board to support missions and to be a part of that force for good and use their, for example, CSR strategies and policies to shape the culture that they are existing within. And we are seeing that. We're seeing that with Spotify engaging with Sounds Right, for example, which I think actually one of the other speakers is going to be talking about. And we're seeing that with, you know, the work that I do. We work really closely with TikTok directly, and we see a genuine effort from TikTok's side to engage in the information integrity space and ensure that they are doing the most that they can do to, you know, despite what the news might say, my experience at least is that there's a genuine effort there. And I do think that's also about, like, how do you make these big entities feel responsible for that? Because again, they have corporate interests too. So it's got to be a multi-pronged effort. And to your point, it cannot sit on a nicely packaged, beautiful campaign. That's never going to, and never has been, the way that that will work. It might be a way that it lifts an issue into people's cultural imagination, but it's got to happen on a much broader scale and in a lot more places.
Thank you.
In terms of balancing urgency with hope, I think to sort of keep people engaged and keep them inspired, because obviously doom narratives are so loud, but hope can obviously feel very naive, particularly at the moment, I think, with what you've just sort of alluded to in terms of the kind of media situation that we're facing at the moment. So how do you keep that sort of balance there?
So that's a really interesting question, because there is a lot of research. In fact, we ran a campaign a year and a half ago called The Future Thanks You, which was all about running experimental interventions on disengaged audiences to understand like what can drive people to action. And it came from a piece of research from the Yale Institute for Climate Change Communications, where they ran a big piece of research against audiences to understand what actually motivates people to action. And we know that doom doesn't work. It never has, right? Like, the sky is falling, like I said at the beginning, like saying to people, this big thing is coming and it's going to, you know, destroy the world as you know it, doesn't work, because people just go, okay, then. So what do I do? I'm just a person. I have a life to, like, how can I stop the sky from falling? But I think it's about, yes, framing things in a hopeful way, but also framing things, again, in people's lived experience. One of the things that we found from that piece of research that we ran on right-leaning audiences in Europe, for example, is, yes, the hopeful narratives, the ones that give people a sense of what they can do, really, really helped. But they didn't like this. There's this thing called hope washing, where you just go, everything's going to be great. Switch over to new renewables. Your life is going to change. That doesn't work either. You have to frame it in, hey, your bills are really high. It's not like an immediate solution, but did you know that switching over to... So, you know, it's about like trying to frame things in a way that also feels pragmatic and that it applies to people's daily lives. And the last thing I'll say is on the Future Thanks You, the campaign that we ran, what we did was we took basically the world through a visioning exercise. And what we did was we had an online sort of portal that we took people through. And we asked people to imagine that they woke up in the year 2045 and the world was completely different. It was a better place. And we asked them three questions. The first question was, what do you do for your work? And there was sort of multiple choice there. The second question was, what's changed in the world to make it a better place? And we put lots of options there too. And then the third question was, you look out the window, what do you see? And it was an open field. And honestly, we didn't know how people were going to get engaged with this. We were just interested to see if a journey like that would lift people's ability to imagine a better future, and if that imagining then made them more likely to act. And we were surprised by how stark the results were. We got over 35,000 in-depth responses from the general public around the world, writing sometimes at length how they imagined looking out the window, seeing their grandchildren playing in the grass, seeing clean water, clean air, nature. I think it was 48% of people mentioned nature without being prompted. And again, in this journey, we didn't talk about climate, we didn't talk about energy, but we found that people found those narratives themselves. So I suppose what I'm saying is that if we can give people something to hope for, if we can give people a vision of a world that they can hope for, then we can also work out how to, you know, nudge people to demand the kind of changes we need to get to that world.
But how important is hope, you know, at the forefront of that storytelling? Because ultimately, once hope is lost, people just lose any kind of like impetus to do anything or make any changes at all.
Hope is critical. Without hope, there is no action. There's nothing for people to take any action for. Hope is incredibly mobilizing. And at the moment, I think one of the pervasive forces in our societies is fear, and really a lot of people acting and reacting through their fearfulness of different things happening. And I think if we could instead switch to people acting from a place of hope and community and building something, then we would be all the better for it.
How do you unearth this as a sort of a tactic or a storytelling campaign format, I suppose, it sounds a bit crude, but, you know, how do you decide that this is kind of the way that you're going to take this storytelling forward and know, you know, which kind of way is going to be the most effective?
I think it's a, you know, again, it's a combination of things. I think that building strong partnerships and coalitions and having, you know, many different actors in many different places moving in this, a similar direction. But I also think that ensuring, like, we do a lot of very rigorous testing methodologies to actually understand our audiences and actually see where things are shifting and working. And I think it's about, again, like, we need these efforts to be happening on a much larger scale in many different places. So I think it's also about sharing these learnings. And it's not that everything has to be done in the same way and perfectly, but at least having the sort of understanding, shared understanding across different sectors, that these kinds of messages, these kinds of interventions can be really successful. But I mean, I think ultimately it's about scale and how do we achieve that scale and how do we convince, I suppose, in a dream world, how do you convince media networks, political actors, and people operating at systems level that hope mobilizes? And again, just to end on an example that's grounded in reality, look at Mamdani's campaign in New York recently. He ran an incredibly successful campaign in the center of finance, in, you know, a state that they're not going to vote it someone in just because they're an optimist, right? But he ran a campaign that was both pragmatic and hope-filled, and it worked incredibly well. So yeah, I think there are models for how hope can motivate and mobilize people when it's paired with something that makes people confident that that hopeful vision will improve their daily lives.
I was going to ask you, in terms of the job that you do at Purpose, like, what is the most inspiring campaign or the most moving, well-framed and narratively structured idea that you've witnessed in all the time? Because you must spend a lot of time consuming other people's work in that way.
I mean, Mamdani is the best campaign that I've seen run in a very long time. I think that he was very smart. He went on a single issue, which was affordability, cost of living, and he wasn't swayed from that narrative. And what that did was give him a sort of Teflon when people tried to come at him with the race baiting and trying to talk about, you know, his Muslim faith and all of these other things, distract with that identity politics, which again pervades so much of our systems right now. And just by constantly sticking to the thread of, like, I'm not going to talk about that, I'm going to talk about the fact that New Yorkers have a difficult daily life and I want to solve that, gave him this kind of vehicle that I think is, you know, obviously the reason why he resonated with people from across all sides and was incredibly successful. Also, it was a beautifully designed, gorgeous campaign. I think it was brilliant.
We all need one of him in our lives, I think, in every country. It's like,
actually, and another example of, it's not a campaign, but again, it's about culture, is the Super Bowl halftime show. We've just seen, you know, in a moment in America where things are divided into turmoil, Bad Bunny deliver a halftime show completely in Spanish as a Puerto Rican, which, you know, is American territory. And it was beautiful. And I think has delivered impact in terms of people's cultural perceptions, and the way that he also depicted Latin culture, I thought was really beautiful, really embedding it actually in a lot of what people might call conservative values, right? Like in marriage, in small business owners, in community, all of these things. And actually, you know, there's a lot of religious iconography as well. I think it was very smart. And actually, you know, that is the way that cultural campaigns should operate.
Well, sure. I mean, yeah. But how much of responsibility do you think musicians like that do have to kind of stick to their guns in that way? I mean, how important is that for you?
No, I think that the responsibility definitely shouldn't necessarily fall on individual musicians. However, when you are a musician with a platform and you feel able to lead in that way, I think it's an amazing thing to be able to do. I think it sits more with the institutional level. For me, like, it sits on, you know, it sits on a broadcaster to see how successful that was and say, okay, we need to make more of this. We need to encourage the kind of content that inspires this kind of response.
I think the Super Bowl's always done a little bit of that, though, actually, notoriously. I mean, that performance with Beyonce and the whole Snoop Dogg and that whole performance, I mean, that one always sticks in my mind, and the way, you know, that kind of like urban subculture and very much being from the ghetto kind of like and rising up. It was, I don't know, that one always really, really stuck out for me particularly, and I've watched it, I don't know, hundreds of times. And I don't know how big the audience of the Super Bowl is, but everything you just described for sure, I think, hit home for a lot of people.
I can't remember the actual statistics, but I think 68 million people have watched the halftime show. So that's, you know, it's a huge number of people. And only 5 million watched the alternative Turning Point show. So I think that also shows, like, good music does actually prevail too.
It's very important, which is, as Adam said in, one of the lead curator of TEDx Ibiza, he was saying that's our first experience of culture, probably, in terms of every single human being on planet Earth. The first thing they probably experience when they come into life is music. You know, it's the first point of contact, I would say, in so many ways, and something that shapes and influences us throughout our entire lives in terms of our memory recall and all sorts of things. So I think it is incredibly important. Unfortunately, we are running out of time. I know we have to go. I could talk to you for hours. Thank you so much, Isabel Bruce from Purpose. And it's been an absolute joy. And we can't wait to see your talk at TEDx Ibiza, the final speaker on stage on the 14th of March.
Thank you so much. It was a lovely conversation.
Likewise.